C1 PR. Number 18A.
This book really could be summarized in the definition of God. Really, the definition of God would give everything, the whole textbook, if we would understand those 11 terms in it. So, we certainly have to be clear that our whole consecration goes out to understand those 11 terms and the relation which they have between themselves. This is more or less to apologize myself that I start all over again with mind, spirit, soul. But frankly, these last year or two, I just can't get away from going over and over the same fundamental point. Every time, as if it were new to me, every time with a new hope, with a new promise, and I see that I can do nothing besides God. And God is just those 11 terms. So don't be cross with me if I go again through the 1, 2, 3, because let's be very clear about it, that principle cannot use us until principle can speak through our spiritual sense. Principle cannot use us and come to us and abide with us until spiritual sense welcomes it. But how to get spiritual sense? Well, the third prayer touches for the first time the question of spiritual sense. There you have for the first time the term spiritual sense. And the whole third prayer is really showing us how through rebuking things, how through rebuking that argument which does not want to go through the first and second prayer, how through that rebuking of that greatest sin, greatest human sin, I put the stress on human sin, the greatest human sin is not to go the way which is shown. And through rebuking that sin, that human sin, we see how she ends up the third prayer, how that nurtures spiritual sense against emotionalism. Now, only when we come to the point that we have culture through the first and second prayer, spiritual sense in us, we have a chance that principle comes to us and talks to us through that spiritual sense. So, we see that already from the matrix we know that soul is that point where the modus operandi changes from the world as the world to the world as the Christ. And the Christ comes in and talks to us and puts some demands to us and takes us and leads us on, you see, and makes us a revolutionary and revolutionizes the world. But to get there, we need the world as the world. So let's have a good, sound preparation. And I think a good, sound preparation is one always goes again through that 1, 2, 3, but not in a repetitory way, not in a schematic way, but always with a new sense, as if we had never heard anything of mind, spirit, and soul, as if we would have never heard anything of the first and second and third prayer. Now, let's take that same problem of the first, second, and third prayer is really depicted already in the Bible, only that the Bible depicts it from the point of view of God, whereas the chapter on prayer depicts it from the point of view of the signs of Christianity. But let's see how very parallel the first 3,000 years run. And I tell you that story not because you know it already by heart what the first 3,000 year period are, but I want to go through that story quickly only with one aim in view, namely to show that the third thousand year is the outcome of the second thousand year, and that the second thousand year could not stand if there was no first thousand year. What? You see, the parallel is quite striking. The first thousand year is what? A wonderful promise. It says, seek God. What do you find? The presentation of God in his sevenfold nature. Just as the first prayer, the first description of the definition of God. It starts with where it must start, namely that it first says, first I must give you a vision of what God is, of what constitutes God through the 7 days of creation. And that's the all of God. And so when somebody came along like Enoch, who walked with God, who did that, what the first prayer says, who was seeking for God, who was trying to go in the line with God, who was trying to get in line with what God is, God took him away. He was transformed. So first we have the vision and the promise. The seeking, which gives us the vision of the all, and we must have the all, the seven first, before we can go on to Noah, to the second thousand year period. But there is an interesting point that right at the beginning of the second thousand year period, what was uncovered there was the tendency to make this vision at once practical in the human. You remember how that second thousand year period started? How the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, and they bare children. How there was a trying to take that Son of God, that vision of what God and man is, and make it practical where we are, namely in the material. And what they did, they mixed it. And their children which they bore were wicked. They were giants of wickedness. Big mortal error. Well, how is it in us? In us, that tendency is prevalent, that the moment we have got the vision of the 7 days, the moment we have studied the seven synonymous terms, the moment we have seen some wonderful presentation of science, whatever it is, we say, now let's make it practical right where we are. That's not the order. Only the fifth thousand year comes and says, how I can make it practical. The second thousand year comes and says, no, you can't, you are not yet ready for it. What is making you ready for it? The Noah story. To be Noah. See, that tendency to sidestep the divine order made a big chaos, and wickedness was on the world. And God said, no, I must destroy that wickedness. What is necessary is Noah. What did he do? He did exactly what the second prayer says, the divine being must be reflected by man. So he took the whole thing into his ark. He took it in. He took it in his ark and nurtured it and kept it pure and kept it safe. And what did he do? He did what I thought I had to apologize. He went over that whole story 7 days and looked out for a solution, couldn't see one. He went over that story of 7 days again and he looked out and he saw a little bit of progress. You see, he did this 7 days and 7 days, but he took in his ark his whole vision. Everything of the universe he took in. But he took it in and kept it quiet. In the quiet sanctuary of spirit, he kept it. He kept it for himself. He pondered it and pondered it. Just one light upward, always upward. He hitched his wagon to the star and worshipped what he had. That's the second step. And out of this second step, see, came then that point where he could be safe. But it didn't change him. It didn't change him. He went out of the ark and had a good drop of wine, apparently, and was drunk. Well, that happens. That's the law. That the children of 2 years and under are not safe. So, something more is necessary. Well, then came the third 1,000-year period of Abraham. But didn't Abraham himself make up his mind to go out of Ur, of the Chaldeans? No. See, he starts with the first 1,000 years, where metaphysically we are at that point where we seek the first 1,000 years, the 7 days, the seven synonymous term, and we get a promise. And then we can't leave it there. We have to be Noah and take it into the ark and nurture it and welcome it and hug it and see that it is kept pure from the outside, and the world goes on besides that, tossing and roaring, and the floods come, and you just are in that wonderful, quiet sanctuary of our vision and loving the vision, where we today just can say, well, the world goes on and must go on and will go on, but what does it matter? Spiritual evolution is the only thing that is worthwhile. And so we can be quiet in the whole world situation. Ponder it, ponder it. And as we ponder it long enough, and ponder it long enough, little by little, we get out of the danger of getting drunk again. And little by little, as we are sincere, then something in us says, now, get out of the old rut. Get out of darkness, out of the Ur in Chaldea. See, that is an impelling force. He didn't question, should I go, shouldn't I not go? He didn't question, where does it lead me? And he didn't know where he would go. But he knew that he will go somewhere which is good, and which is grand, and which is infinite. See, it was that point where Abraham had digested the first 1,000 years and the second 1,000 years to the point where he was no more in danger of getting drunk and therefore be killed by the herald, thought. But where in himself the seed was working and working, and the seed was bringing forth its own seed, and it was definite. And that whole 1,000-year period is just one big picture of the definiteness of those big characters like Abraham, Jacob, and Joseph, and Moses, and Joshua, and Judges. They just knew what they will be doing, and they just stuck to it until they were reformed. So, let's think that 1, 2, 3 over, because it helps us not to fall in danger. Namely, that we think we can work out something of the third day without going through the first and second day. Just as we can't build a house without a foundation. We can't say, well, I'm building first my roof. We can't. First must be the foundation. And even if it's digging in the dirt, it's doing something marvelous. And the first and third, the second and third, are really digging and laying a good and solid foundation. Then principle can come and talk to us, and we will hear it, and we will be glad to go the way which principle shows us. So, did I make that clear, the order, that it is a birth But it is not knowing what the third thousand year is. I can know what the third thousand year is. I can say, yes, the third thousand year I know is that story of Abraham and how he went out of Ur in Chaldea, how he was renamed and transformed, how Jacob struggled with himself, and how he served again and again. I can know that. But that is not the point of soul. That's the point of knowing. That's mine. Only as I know, I build the link that something is growing and growing in me and giving birth in me and giving birth in me until it is so strong in me. The second prayer ended with that strength. It's the strong pinions of love. Until something is so strong in me that by itself it ousts out of me all that is unlike my true self. And then the birth is harmonious, is safe and natural. Then I can say, I have experienced a little bit of Abraham, or of Jacob, or of Joseph, or of Moses. Only then. So it is a birth. And it's a birth which is spiritual and not of the nature of thinking. Well, those 3,000 year periods are really marvelous. But somehow I just have to go on a little bit. And I come to the fourth prayer. And the fourth prayer, we remember, gave a key right at the beginning of the text by saying, the danger from prayer is that it may lead us into temptation. By it we may become involuntary hypocrites. Here we have that sentence which says, well, be careful about praying. It may lead us into temptation. It may lead us into danger. In the ordinary sense of prayer, we always feel no, praying is always something good. If it doesn't do any good, well, it doesn't do any harm, at least. But here we come to the point where it says, no, if we have not the scientific sense of prayer, it can do harm to me and to others. Why? Well, she says here, perhaps you have noticed that, how in this fourth prayer she shows how empty the prayer as such is. She robs the mere fact of praying of its power, of the belief that there is power in just praying, and that in ordinary prayer. See, that, well, let me just take a few passages just to epitomize it. She says, a worthy prayer may give us a quiet sense of self-justification, but makes us a hypocrite. See, it is negative. Or to be apparently fervent and prayerful does not mean to be pure and sincere. This is just, or she says, professions and audible prayers cover the multitude of sins. Just once here, about a dozen or even more passages where she points out that the mere fact of what is called praying has nothing in itself, has no power, no principle in itself, and therefore no spiritual power, and therefore it is of no avail. Well then, what is of avail? What sort of prayer then is of avail? Also, she points out here that she says, well, prayer usually says, prayer is here that I get pardoned. That if I have sinned, well, that's that. But prayer is here that I get pardoned. You see, it wants to sidestep the third prayer, which says, well, the third prayer is the prayer of sinlessness, where we have to rebuke sins. Theological prayer comes in and says, well, after all, if you have sinned, there is a way out. You can go and pray, and then you will pardon. But it says, principle does not pardon error. It demands correction. So the fourth prayer is that prayer really which robs the belief, or which, now, my English is not good enough now. See, she wants to say, ordinary prayer has that belief that if you pray for pardon, that it has the power to be pardoned. And she comes and says, no. Prayer as such has nothing in itself at all. And so really demands something quite different, namely honesty. It says, what we need is an honest man, or what we need is a principled attitude. A principled attitude, she says, that's prayer. She says, a principled attitude that reflects the divine principle, and therefore a principled attitude reflects spiritual power, and therefore that has power of correction. But how do I express a principled attitude? And so we see here through the fourth subject, as you may have seen yourself, how she brings out now that what is asked and what is necessary is that we do those first three prayers. The first prayer said, well, I seek God as He is. The second prayer said, I worship this vision and worship it. And third, I keep that worship free from any interference and temptation. I keep it sinless. And then comes the fourth and says, well, that's nice, but do you do it always? Do you do it? And do you do it spasmodically? Or do you do it always? In other words, are these first three prayers your attitude? Your whole makeup? That's what he asked. Is that your whole makeup? Then if it's that your whole makeup, well then you reflect the principled attitude. And the principled attitude has power. Then we are an honest man. In the question 25, which I put to you for investigation, you may have seen, as I ask you, can you see how she gives in one way what is an honest principle attitude, and how often in this fourth prayer she depicts that dishonest attitude, which is sometimes unwillingly, unconsciously within our whole makeup. It isn't just dishonesty out of sheer badness, but it is unwilling hypocrisy. It's because we are unconscious that we are a hypocrite. See, she uncovers hidden hypocrisy, and not just outward and hypocrisy. Well, you may have seen in that question 25 how she depicts, say, the attitude of an honest or principled attitude by speaking of honesty, of self-knowledge, of reflection, of self-examination, which is self-criticism, or of self-critics, of unselfishness. You see, a principled, no more a selfish person, of self-sacrificing, of giving up ourselves, and so. And on the other side, you had all those many different aspects of dishonesty, like self-deception. Well, a lot of these words which I use here are really not from the text, but implied by the text, because I can't always read all a whole sentence which brings it out. But to give the feel of it, you may have seen how this fourth prayer wants to correct that in us which is hypocritical, which is dishonest, because so much in us is self-deceiving and self-justifying or self-hiding. We hide ourselves or hide our feelings, hide our deeds. It's a self-fooling or overestimating oneself or underestimating ourselves. You see, it just isn't coincident with what we really are. So, first, we are clear about this point that the fourth subject has as its goal of correction that sense of dishonesty. Well, what does correct dishonesty? Honesty. What is honesty? Well, honesty isn't the moral honesty which she is asking here. It is a principled honesty, or we would say a principled attitude, which is asked from here. Now, what is a principled attitude? How are we a principled personality? See, just to say, well, I must be principled in all what I do, that's very nice to say. But how? How can I do it? I always ask myself, how? That is perhaps something which is just innate in me. I only always want to know how, why, wherefore, for what purpose. I always ask questions. Well, here we see that in order to be principled, or be a principled personality, I must see that principle must sound through everything. Because person means, as you know, personare, to sound through. Well, to sound through what? Principle is one principle and is whole, therefore it is that point where it says, all right, the first prayer, the second prayer, the third prayer, they together must sound through everything in my whole makeup. In what I do, in what I feel, in what I say, in what I intend, in what I express, in what I accomplish, see, must sound through everything. Then it is principle. See, I'm not principled when I say to myself, oh yes, in order to solve this and this problem, I have to take this and this attitude. And I may take that attitude, and afterwards I go on in the old way. Then I have tried to take for once a right attitude, and I leave it again. Or where I say, well, for these and these problems in my life, I take a scientific or a principled attitude, but for other things it doesn't matter really. Then I'm not principled. Then I try to use the first, second and third prayer only for certain occasions. Then I'm not principled. Fine, if I use the principle only for certain occasions, then I'm not principled. Does that click? And that's what she says right at the beginning of the fourth prayer, that she says, by it we may become involuntary hypocrites, uttering desires which are not real, and consoling ourselves in the midst of sin with the recollection that either we have prayed over it, I have been principled before, so I don't need to be principled afterwards, or to mean to ask forgiveness at some later date, where I say, all right, I will be principled tomorrow morning, or this evening, when I have time, then I will pray over it. See, I leave it to be principled to certain times, or certain occasions, or certain phases of being, or it's splitting up the principle attitude instead of having it one. Principle is always that which urges the oneness. So here, principle urges the oneness and continuity and consistency. The term consistent comes in a few times in this prayer. The consistency of the first prayer, the second prayer, and the third prayer. If those three prayers, you see, that's why they are so important. If those three prayers are constant with me and I'm consistent with them, and I have that attitude in what I feel and in what I do and in what I say and in what I intend and what in my motives is and what in my heart is, and so if that just sounds through everything, then I can say I'm a state of prayer. Then I become a state of prayer. The name becomes a state of prayer. Then we are a prayer. Then our whole attitude is one wonderful prayer, a principal prayer. You see, what she wants to say? She wants to say, prayer is not that you say, that you say to yourself, all right, in order to pray, I must pray these and these words. Or in order to pray, I must do this and this outward ritual or so. In order to pray, yes, I will do that before I go to sleep this evening. Or yes, oh yes, every morning when I wake up, I say my prayers. So I have done my prayer in the morning. See, it's splitting up prayer into a time concept or into an occasion of certain occasions. Or it's splitting up. Whereas what she puts forward here is that, well, our whole attitude from morning, noon, and night. There's a new expression in London now, round the clock and round the calendar. You see, it's an attitude. It's an attitude.